I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham.
So we all have values that we live by, and when we can become conscious of the values that we live by and choose the ones that will lead us in the most wholesome direction, we're learning that we can do that. Once we learn we can create a change in our brain, we know that we can create a change in our brain. And so we're much more likely to tackle bigger and bigger issues because we know that we can. That we can put into practice these tools and create a change in our brain that will allow us to keep opening and expanding. So what happens when our brain becomes more resilient, we become more resilient, and we can take action on a larger stage. We can open up into the larger world and be more effective. The capacity to be resilient, the capacity to bounce back, is innate in the human brain. It can be developed, it can be derailed, we can recover it and rewire it. But it's our birthright to be resilient. And so I've simply tried to present tools and techniques that allow us to recover that birthright and allow us to feel centered and grounded in the face of any adversity or any loss or any challenge. And that's quite available to us in this human existence.
Linda Graham, MFT, is a licensed psychotherapist and meditation teacher in full-time practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. She integrates her passion for neuroscience, mindfulness, and relational psychology through trainings, consultations, workshops, and conferences nationally. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Linda has written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. My goodness. Rewiring your brain.
Now that we've learned the magic of neuroplasticity, or confirmed the reality of neuroplasticity in the brain, that the brain can rewire its circuitry, it can rewire its structures in the organization and functioning, we not only have the opportunity to rewire our brains for the better, in some senses we have the responsibility to do that. To make choices that will allow our lives to go more in a direction of resilience and well-being.
So it's no longer this idea of once we get past 30, our brain is set in stone, as it were.
That's right. We can teach an old dog new tricks. And the more we know about which experiences, which tools and techniques work the best, then we can be more safe and efficient and effective in doing that rewiring.
Okay, and a lot of this realization has come through functional MRI imaging.
The technology that has allowed the neuroscientist to peek inside the black box is only about 20 to 30 years old. The research is really about 20 years old. That's one generation of research. We're very fortunate in a way that the neuroscientific research has paralleled the positive psychology movement research, both about 20 years. So even as we understand the benefits of practicing gratitude, kindness, compassion, awe, delight in a behavioral way, the neuroscientists are helping us understand what changes in our brain when we do that.
But absolutely, we're much more than the Skinnerian behavioral box, though, right?
Well, probably the biggest discovery is how to integrate the lower brain, which is unconscious but very, very fast in its responses, with the higher brain, which is much slower but much more comprehensive. And when we understand how to integrate the functioning of the higher brain, where we do all of our executive functioning, planning, decision-making, motivation, with the survival responses that come up from the lower brain, that's actually where we can be resilient. We can be responsive rather than reactive.
So I want to ask you then, because it's right in the title of your book, mm-hmm. what is resilience?
I'm saying that resilience is the capacity to cope with the ups and downs in life, our capacities to meet the challenges and crises that are inevitable in the human condition, and to develop strategies that allow us to meet our disappointments and our disasters with much more adaptability and response flexibility. So what I've keyed in on in the book is response flexibility. That's absolutely one of the functions of our higher executive functioning in the brain. And it's what allows us to shift gears and choose responses that are more adaptive and skillful.
So you have, I noticed, 5 C's in the book. Can you tell us what those are?
I had 5 C's in the book when it went to the printer, and there are now 6.
Only six.
So they are, and they sort of follow the trajectory of becoming more resilient. Calm, which means simply being able to come back to a baseline of equilibrium so that we can respond to what's happening. Compassion, which is often what allows us to return to that sense of calm. Clarity, which allows us to see clearly what's happening and our reactions to what's happening. And then connections to resources. And those could be people, resources, or places, or practices like meditation or prayer. And then competence, so we have a sense of efficacy and mastery in what we're doing in our lives, and a sense of courage so that we can go into the new or the unknown.
And I notice you were also talking about something that's pretty hot on the psychological forefront, which is attachment theory.
Oh, yes. So attachment theory, which has been around now for 50 or 60 years.
But it hasn't come to the forefront like it has.
Well, attachment theory is the basis of a lot of the contemporary therapeutic modalities because, in a sense, the therapy relationship is a reattachment relationship. It's a reparenting relationship.
Yep.
So what happens with attachment, I mean, the power of attachment, is those early interactions are what kindle the development of the brain in the first place. So the more secure and responsive those interactions are, we have a base inside that actually buffers us from stress and trauma and psychopathology. So secure attachment is just really the thing for resilience.
What are the types of attachment?
There's secure attachment, which means basically a trust in other human beings, a capacity to regulate your own emotions, a trust in yourself that you can regulate your own emotions and get what you need from other people. There are 2 kinds of insecure attachment. So secure attachment shortcut means being both stable and flexible in our relationships and in how our brain works. There's an insecure avoidant style of attachment where if there was a sense of indifference or neglect or no one's paying any attention to me, I'm all on my own here.
The caregiver you're talking about.
That's right. Then the style becomes to avoid emotions. They're just too messy. Or avoid people that might trigger emotions. And the person becomes very self-reliant. There is a lot of support in our culture for that style of attachment. I'm the lone ranger here. Yeah. I can do it all myself.
Yeah.
The other kind of... I want to say that one of my mentors, Bonnie Badenoch, calls that style of insecure avoidant, which can become kind of rigid, neural cement. It's harder for us to be open to learn from new experiences. We tend to get set in our ways.
All because it's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
It would be dangerous to open to new experience. Yeah, something might happen.
Because you wouldn't know
right. If
there would be any support there or not, whereas the secure attachment goes, oh, well, I can go out on the skinny branches and... Well, of course, I might not know what will happen, but always before, I've been able to bounce back.
That's exactly right. And always before, I've been able to count on other people to help me bounce back. If the branch falls off, someone will catch me.
That's a critical thing.
That's a critical thing.
Yeah.
So the other style of insecure attachment is what's called insecure anxious, where there's been some unpredictability or volatility in the early caregiving relationship, where the person just really doesn't know. Am I important? Do you ever see me? Do I matter? Because you seem to be so absorbed in your own world, and I'm constantly begging for crumbs of attention. And so that style is where a person might be too focused on other people and not enough on themselves. In the avoidance style, the person might be too focused on themselves and not enough on other people. So that's what Bonnie calls neural swamp. And the advantage of the secure style of attachment, besides behaviorally, we have more trust, where it's easier for us to relate to people. We generally trust that relationships will work out well. The brain is more stable and flexible in its functioning, and the prefrontal cortex will develop fully. It will mature fully. Then it can do its functions, which are really important. I call the prefrontal cortex the CEO of resilience.
Right.
Because what it does, and this is a long list, but it's so important, it regulates the body and our nervous system. It regulates our revving up into fight, flight, freeze, or our collapsing down into lethargy or depression. It regulates that. It quells the fear response of the amygdala directly. So if we go into a stress response, there are ways we can calm that fear response down immediately. It manages all of our emotions, all the emotions surging through our body, which are simply signals to take action. It's a signal to do something to protect ourselves or protect somebody
else.
But
it's not always rational or thought through, those signals to do something.
But when the prefrontal cortex is the executive center of the brain,
right,
when it's functioning well and functioning maturely, it can take all of those emotions. It's not hijacked by them. We don't have to repress them or push them away. We don't feel flooded. We just say, oh, I'm angry. Who am I angry at? And what should I do about that?
So you can go to a meta position.
A meta position.
Yeah.
Right. That's what the prefrontal cortex does. It's meta.
Okay.
It's also what allows us to attune to ourselves and other people, to empathize with ourselves and other people, which is the basis of a lot of our decision making of how we want to navigate our world. Mm-hmm. And it's the structure that allows insight and self-awareness. And it's the structure of response flexibility. So the more we can strengthen the functioning of the prefrontal cortex, the more resilient we're going to be.
So you talk about also habits that we get into. There's a table on page 17, which is the resonance circuit of the social brain. Talk to us a little bit about the lower brain and the higher brain. I mean, you have been already for a moment here.
Right. So, and I will come back and talk about habits, because so much of what we're doing when we're rewiring the brain to be resilient is creating new habits.
Building habits.
New conditioning.
Yeah, okay.
Or we're reconditioning
right.
the old habits, or right. we're deconditioning the old habits. And those are very powerful mechanisms in the brain. So I would want to come back to that.
Oh, please.
Okay. But in terms of the lower brain and the higher brain, I began to talk about the resonance circuit because how we pick up the vibe of other people, how we understand what's going on in our own experience, how we attune and communicate with other people really depends on this integration of lower brain and higher brain functioning. So in the lower brain, in the brainstem, which is the most primitive part of the brain, we pick up the initial vibe of somebody. You can walk into a room and you get a feeling. Is this safe or is this dangerous? And the brainstem is where we get our first responses of safe or dangerous.
And we have actual science to back this up now, right?
Of course we do.
Okay.
Right, that's what's so exciting.
But we didn't used to, though.
No, we didn't used to. But now when we can understand how to work with those fast responses of our brainstem and our limbic system, then we can be much more resilient.
Yeah.
So the brainstem is what allows us to just resonate or pick up the vibe of other people. And we know if we feel safe or we feel dangerous. Of course, our experiences can shape that perception. It can sometimes distort that perception.
As in the insecure attachment styles that
right.
you were talking about earlier. Yes.
Right. But we can learn how to work with that. The midbrain, the limbic system, and the household word is the amygdala, which is our fear center. Is what begins to give an emotional valence to that sense of safe, dangerous, or life-threatening. And it begins to give us a sense of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. The amygdala fires very, very quickly, and it's what allows us to activate the sympathetic nervous system. I'm going to fight, flight, freeze. I'm going to do something to protect myself.
Yes.
Or it can activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which makes us numb out or collapse or shut down.
We have to take a short break. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And we're here with my guest, Linda Graham. And how can people contact you, Linda?
My web address is lindagraham-mft.net. So that's M as in Mary, F as in Frank, T as in Tom. It means I'm a marriage and family therapist.
And do you have a phone number or prefer?
The phone number is 415-924-7765.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break and be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham, who has written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. And before the break, Linda, you were talking about the amygdala.
Right, so it's kind of interesting that we took the break just between the lower brain and the higher brain, because very often for many people they're not very well integrated. and we live in one or the other. So the lower brain, the amygdala, is what's giving us our emotional valence, the beginning of our feelings of fear, of sadness, of anger, of anxiety, of grief. The amygdala tends to be biased toward negative emotions because that's what keeps us alive.
Oh, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that was being played on in the previous administration, in the manipulation of the negative bias. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
There is an innate negativity bias in the brain that allows us to survive as individuals and as species, so that it's more important that we react to something as though it were dangerous, even if it's not, and live, than if we don't react to something that in fact is dangerous and we're not knowing that it is, and we die. So the negativity bias over time, over evolution, is what has allowed us to survive as a species. We're never not going to have that. But we can learn how to work with that or how to regulate that.
And it's still in the lower brain.
It's
though,
in the lower brain.
Point. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So it's really not mediated by the executive function, and it can shut down the executive function.
It can hijack it, right. Oh, it can preempt it.
All right. Right.
It won't necessarily shut it down, but it preempts it.
Sure.
So we just lose our cool. We have a fit or we shut down and we just can't think straight. And that could happen for a minute or two or an hour or two or a day or two. I mean, so we want to keep the prefrontal cortex, that executive functioning, very strong,
Yes. Which
is a big part of why we practice mindfulness so that we can always come back to that quickly.
Well, with all of these things, the brain you talk about, and I have to say you're probably the first psychologist who has really taken into account and developed workable exercises with many of the disciplines of the Eastern religions. And I really appreciate that.
What I wanted to do when I wrote the book, and we're still going to get to the higher brain and to our habits, right?
Yes, yes.
What I wanted to do when I wrote the book was to be able to integrate the wisdom of the Eastern contemplative traditions with Western psychology, because the paradigms are very, very different about
yes,
the view of the self.
Yep.
So Western psychology, I'm a psychotherapist, so we work very hard to help strengthen an authentic, adaptive sense of self, which is necessary. In the Eastern traditions, we also practice to let go or dissolve that sense of self into something vaster and more open. And both are necessary. Neither one alone is sufficient. Both are necessary. And they operate very differently in the brain. So when we can do both, when we can actually focus on tools and techniques that will strengthen a sense of self, self-referential network in the brain, and when we can actually relax the guardianship of that mode of processing and allow ourselves to go, people can easily do this in a sense of reverie or daydream, but we can also cultivate practices that allow us to go into a much more open, spacious awareness. The brain operates differently there, and we have a different experience of epiphany or revelation or insight that we're not necessarily going to get when we're focused on a task, when we're focused on the details.
And this has already been tracked by studying monastics in MRI machines, which gives some direct evidence about what's happening.
Right. Much of the research done on mindfulness practices and the effect on the brain has been done by Richie Davidson at his neuroimaging lab at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he's been able to invite very adept monk practitioners into the lab. They're all hooked up. They're willing to be scanned. And he can see immediately the effect in the brain of doing a compassion practice or doing a mindfulness practice. And in fact, I just posted a resource about this recently. His lab, in conjunction with other labs, has just released a study that meditation practice actually changes gene expression of the genes that regulate the processes of inflammation in the body. So that when we meditate, we're actually regulating the gene expression of inflammation, which helps us recover from stress faster.
That's extraordinary.
It totally is extraordinary to be able to see that and
document
that.
Yes, well, and it's been a thing for some time now in medical practice about evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes directly in support of that.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm finding, there are a lot of tools and techniques
right. That
I teach in the book. And I've learned them in my own clinical experience and in my own meditation practice. And I've learned what works.
Right.
But to have the science behind it, when I'm talking to a client about why putting their hand on their heart calms down their amygdala, or why when you cultivate positive emotions, you're going to live 7 to 9 years longer. I mean, when there's science behind it, then clients actually get very excited about doing these practices.
Yes, I can imagine.
And they can also see the immediate effect of it.
Yeah, yeah. So let's continue on into the higher brain.
So in terms of the resonance circuit, the amygdala is what begins to give us an emotional valence of our experience, and it tends to be biased.
By valence, what do you mean by valence?
Just the feeling of it, the importance of it. And it tends to be negatively biased. Now, many neuroscientists say that the negativity bias comes up through the right hemisphere of the brain, which develops sooner than the left hemisphere.
Well, I knew that, but I didn't know it was predominantly from the right side.
Well, then what the importance of that is that the right hemisphere is more neuronally connected to the lower brain. It's more connected to the limbic system, so that it carries forward this negativity bias. And so, in fact, when we're operating out of our right hemisphere, we can be more vulnerable to anxiety, depression, shame, grief, just the more negative, powerful emotions. The left hemisphere, which comes online, activates maybe a year or two after the right hemisphere, though it's still very young, by 3 years of age. But when the left hemisphere comes online, and of course they're both conscious, but the left hemisphere is more abstract, symbolic, language-oriented, linear-oriented, and it develops later, so it has perhaps less negative experiences or more resources to cope with them. It's not so connected to the lower brain. So when we tell ourselves, oh, stop feeling that way, there's no conduit for the information to get to the amygdala. It really doesn't work. But when we can integrate the right and left, we integrate our feelings with our thoughts. We integrate our sense of social self with our sense of personal self. When we're more integrated, then the prefrontal cortex, which is right in the middle, does all that integration, is able to calm down the fear response of the amygdala.
So I want to ask a quick aside here. With the prefrontal cortex connecting both of the hemispheres, would you say that women have a better capacity for attending in a connected emotional way than men because of that brain makeup and because their corpus callosum is larger than males?
Right. So what Luann Brizendine at UCSF has said is that the corpus callosum, which connects the right and left hemispheres and does a lot of that integration, is thicker in women.
Yes.
It's just thicker. And so women seem to be more able, readily, innately, to integrate the functioning of the two hemispheres. So the feelings are allowed to integrate with thoughts. But what can also do that integration is the anterior cingulate cortex, which is it's the structure right behind the prefrontal cortex. They work very closely together. And it's what allows us to focus our attention. Mindfulness strengthens the functioning of the anterior cingulate cortex. So we focus our attention, and it's the structure of the brain that allows us to distinguish between physical and emotional pain, and it also allows us to integrate our feelings and our thoughts. So when we do our mindfulness practice, we're directly strengthening the structures of the brain that can do that integration.
So I was going to say it might be better for us to have more women in monastics in Congress because it would be more connected with what's happening in the real world,
well,
in
you
a
know,
manner of speaking.
Tim Ryan does now teach mindfulness in Congress.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They have Tara Brach has been helping him do that in Washington, D.C.
That's fantastic.
So they have regular meditation sessions.
Well, let's hope for some fruitfulness coming out of that. But continue in the discussion of the higher brain and habits, please.
So one of the things we have found that happens when we cultivate positive emotions, so the right hemisphere has carried forward the negativity bias of the lower brain. When we deliberately cultivate positive emotions like gratitude, kindness, compassion, joy, awe, delight, love, curiosity, there's what they call a left shift in the brain. That was seen in Richie Davidson's lab. So when we cultivate positive emotions, there's more neural activity lighting up in the left hemisphere of the brain. They call it the left shift. And because the right hemisphere of the brain tends to have a withdraw, avoid style toward experience, and the left hemisphere of the brain tends to have an open approach style to experience, when we cultivate positive emotions, one of the direct outcomes is we remain more open to our experience.
That's fascinating.
We remain more open to learning.
Because I've been looking at the work of Ian McGilchrist and his hemisphericy, and he's talking about that the left brain tends to be, and of course this is in the now outdated work of Julian Jaynes and I can't remember, Ornstein, I believe it was, also talking about the left brain being primarily logical and the right brain being primarily creative.
There are certainly tendencies, and neuroscientists are still doing that today. Mm-hmm. That, yes, Dan Siegel says the left brain is 3 L's, logical, language, and linear, and that it processes information in that way. Whereas the right hemisphere, it seems, is more spatial-oriented, more visual-oriented, senses-oriented, emotion-oriented, relational-oriented. And in fact, I've heard Alan Shore, who's one of the earlier pioneers about right hemisphere work, say that it's almost like having two brains in one skull. They're connected by the corpus callosum, but that they can operate very differently. So there is still something to the... where it's been useful to me, Jonah Lehrer, in his book Imagine, says that really the right hemisphere is the seat of intuition and creativity. Where we have a more defocused mode of processing. The ideas just kind of link up out of the blue. Whereas the left hemisphere is more oriented toward details and tasks and productivity. And that we need both. We need to be creative and productive.
Absolutely.
Both.
Yep.
And we can be sort of biased one direction or the other, but we're not going to function in as holistic a way.
Right. We have to take a short break. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham, who's written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being, and how can people contact you?
My website is lindagraham-mft.net, and the phone number is 415-924-7765.
Stay tuned, because we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham, who has written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. And before the break, Linda, we were talking about brain hemisphericity, and one of the things that I had noticed from not only Ian McGilchrist, but Jill Bolte Taylor, talking about the difference in the functioning of the hemispheres, and it was curious for me to hear you say that the left brain, even in its Siegelian 3 L's, logic, language, and linearity, is more open than the right brain somehow.
Mm-hmm. Because when we overcome that negativity bias, which is meant to help us survive, and that kind of functioning can be much narrower in its focus. But when we open up to other possibilities, other perspectives, other ways of perceiving our experience, and the left hemisphere becomes dominant in the brain after about 3 years of age and remains dominant in the adult brain except for adolescence. They kind of duke it out in adolescence, but then the left brain wins normally. So
about age 25 or something? Or
the prefrontal cortex matures by about age 25.
Oh, I see.
Right. So then hopefully we're fully integrated in our functioning with all of these different coping strategies. But because the left hemisphere of the brain has many, many ways of perceiving and processing experience through symbols, through language, we can read history, we can look at role models. Mm-hmm. There's just a more openness to other perspectives. We have what Barbara Fredrickson calls broaden and build. We can broaden our perspectives and we can build new resources. That tends to make us more optimistic, more creative, more resilient.
Okay. So if that isn't cultivated necessarily, though, the left brain can also be, in a way, more closed than intuitive, would you say?
If it's not integrated with the right hemisphere of the brain, then we can get caught in our ideas, we can get caught in our beliefs, we can get caught in our logic, and not be informed by our intuition or by our senses or by our emotional life.
Because in chapter 2, you talk about when resilience goes awry, and so talk a little bit about that.
What I meant about resilience going awry is that we can form habits. So now we get to come back to habits.
Yes.
Okay. We learn early on basic coping strategies from the people around us.
And what age?
Oh, by the time we're 18 months of age, they're pretty well established in the brain, and that's before there's any conscious choice about them.
Right.
So we learn our coping strategies, and those become they can become a bit inflexible and defensive. So we develop our defenses, which kind of precludes us from learning anything different. So we have habits. They get us by. We do survive. We make a life. But they can block us from learning anything new.
And this is actually before the hippocampus comes online to be making memories too, right?
That's right. So that's why many of these early habits are stored in implicit-only memory. They're stored in unconscious-only memory.
That's critical.
It's very critical. Very critical.
I'm so glad you're being so explicit about this so that people are understanding, well, why do I continue to da-da-da? Mm-hmm. And it's because of this implicit initial impression from the particular attachment style so early on.
Right. So what's important about that, a couple of things that are important about that. We tend to operate about 80% of the time on implicit conditioning. That's just the fact. We drive to work, we know how to cook a meal, we tie our shoes. So many things we do out of habits that have been conditioned early on. When those habits are adaptive, that's great. When they're maladaptive, then that's where we have the responsibility to begin to become aware and make different choices.
And speak about adaptability for a moment, please.
That we can shift gears, shift perspectives, and make different choices.
In a flexible way.
In a flexible way, which is, you know, what mindfulness is all about, to be able to see our experience, to notice and name it, to step back from it and disentangle or disidentify, to see what the different perspectives or options might be, discern which ones are going to be the most helpful, and choose wisely. That's the process of a mindfulness practice. What's going on in the brain, or how we can change this, is once the conditioned habits are established, and again, that's nature's way of being efficient. Conditioning is neutral. It can go positive, it can go negative.
Yeah. But you're so dependent on your initial caregivers that that's part of the reflection of what that care has been like.
What they have found in the attachment theory is that our patterns of attaching and relating and responding to the world are fixed in the circuitry by about 18 months of age, and they will remain stable well into adulthood unless there's an intervention, unless there's a choice. So that's why a lot of what I'm trying to teach in the book is that we have choices and we need to be wise in making those choices.
Well, and it occurs to me that this is some stuff that gets, this sorts of conditioning gets passed on through families unless these interventions
occur. Of course. There's multi-generational transmission of trauma or coping or anything else. So what we can learn how to do is, the first is simply new conditioning. You have a new experience, you create a new habit, you have a new behavior. That can become implicit. The other thing about implicit memory, when we have implicit memories, there's no time stamp. There's no sense that this happened in the past. So we can have a reaction now, and it feels very real now, and there's no sense that we're remembering something that happened to us before.
So is this about the, unfortunately, really intensive conditioning of PTSD?
Right, exactly. Oh, okay. There's no sense that that happened 20 years ago or last week. It's happening to me right now, and I'm reacting right now.
So people are flooded. They're in the moment of the experience.
Right, no sense that they have a choice.
Oh, okay.
That's, no sense that there's a choice.
But that's also what a lot of this generating resilience offers the capability of to develop new choices.
That's right. So the new conditioning is choosing a new experience, creating a new behavior pattern. That can become procedural. That can become a new habit. We don't have to think about it anymore.
A habit of building new habits.
That's right. And so when you cultivate, you can cultivate a forgiveness practice or an equanimity practice or a compassion practice. And over time, that begins to become second nature. You don't have to think about it to react compassionately.
And that's one of the things I think that happens with the monastics.
Right, exactly.
Is people are practicing it so long that they now have laid in this new modality.
It doesn't have to go through conscious processing anymore.
Right.
The second one is reconditioning, which is, and I do teach this in my workshops and I teach it in the book, now the neuroscientists can see it in their scanners, when you have a negative, afflictive, problematic memory. If you can juxtapose that with a contradictory, opposite, positive memory, so that they're opposite of each other, and you hold those two experiences in awareness at the same time, that juxtaposition will cause the neurons holding the memory together to fall apart and rewire. And when you can juxtapose a positive experience with a negative one, neurons fall apart and rewire. The positive experience can rewire the negative experience. So it isn't just, oh, a new habit that's sitting side by side my old habit. The old habit is gone. And this is the basis, the neurological basis of trauma therapy.
Does it really then restructure the neural net in the lower brain?
It restructures the neural net in the higher brain so that we can then use it to regulate our automatic survival responses from the lower brain.
Okay.
We're never not going to react with fear or anger in certain situations.
Right.
That's hardwired by evolution.
Right.
But we can change our responses to fear or our responses to anger or our responses to sadness or depression. The third way is deconditioning. So both new conditioning and reconditioning call on that self-referential network of the brain. It's detail-oriented. It's focused-oriented. We set ourselves a task. The third way is deconditioning. When Marcus Rakeley discovered that when you don't ask the brain to do something, it's not quiet. It's more active
right.
than ever.
That's
it's
right.
just it's firing all over the brain,
yeah.
coming up with new associations and new links. So when we can, in a safe way, access that default network and go into a sense of more open, spacious reverie, this is what Dan Siegel calls the plane of open possibilities, new solutions just come up out of the blue. And this is what people experience if they dream the solution to a problem or they're yeah. walking along the trails in Marin and all of a sudden the answer just pops up. So deconditioning is another way of creating different habits of behavior.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, this is really, I cannot remember where I read it, but I thought there was something about, what do you say is the time frame in which to establish a new habit? Is it like 3 to 5 weeks?
The scientists cannot agree upon that. So it's not a magic number.
Okay.
It's really more important that there's repetition
uh-huh.
over and over and over and over and over.
Right.
It's very important that we're focusing attention mm-hmm. because the focused attention will cause the neurons in the brain to light up and then it'll be receptive to whatever the new experience is.
As Goleman is talking about with his new book.
Right.
Yeah.
So focused attention, repetition, and we're discovering sometimes small is better. Big dramatic changes will encode in the brain, but you can create new habits bit by bit by bit by bit, little and often, little and often.
And so, smaller chunks are much easier to assimilate, I would think, in some modalities. I mean,
and they're also much easier to choose.
Oh, yeah.
Just to set an intention and do a behavior and monitor the results and take it in. It's much easier to create new habits step
but
by step.
But then that habit, that generalized habit assimilation pattern does generalize
mm-hmm.
larger and larger.
What's generalizing is the brain's capacity. So as we get in the habit of creating
new habits,
it becomes easier and easier for the brain to do that.
Yeah.
So then it's less and less effort as we keep going.
Because one of the things that you talk about also, this is the wiser self you have,
mm-hmm.
and this
mm-hmm.
is how to cultivate the wiser self, is it not? Or can
so
you
the,
talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so the wiser self is a term for our own innate goodness, our own innate Buddha nature, our own just higher functioning. And it's how we know ourselves to be good and grateful and generous and compassionate human beings. And so there are exercises to cultivate a sense of that, using guided imagery to cultivate a sense of that, where you can have an image and a name and an object that represents your wiser self. And then being able to use that, because the wiser self is really your intuitive wisdom speaking.
Right, right.
And being able to use that as a resource. So when you have a decision to make or a quandary to solve, it isn't just your adult self that's navigating the world right now trying to figure that out, that you're tapping into deeper wisdom, mm-hmm. deeper intuitive wisdom.
In your chapter 7, in chapter 6 you talk about self-directed neuroplasticity.
Right.
And we've talked a bit about that with the new conditioning, reconditioning, and deconditioning.
Exactly.
But in practicing these many, many exercises, and I'm mm-hmm. just delighted to see how thorough you have
mm-hmm.
been Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been working on this book 10 years, right?
So I was percolating all of the ideas for about 10 years. And once I really got sort of the neuroscience of resilience, it was really 2 years.
Okay.
So, yes, the book has a lot of exercises. And I find that's often how people use the book. There's a table of contents for exercises as well as for the chapters. So people just look for something that's going to be helpful to them and read that part of it.
Because I wanted to say with your chapter 7, it's called Bonding and Belonging. Do you recommend that people do these exercises with someone or
There are some dyadic or small group exercises in the book, but I wrote the book primarily for people to be able to do these on their own. One of the things we do understand from neuroscience is that imagination rewires the brain as much as real life experience. And so people can use their own imagination and use guided imagery and use guided meditations to do the rewiring. So, and that's very often really helpful for people if their relationships with other people have been problematic or traumatizing. It may not feel safe to do that with another person, but you can imagine doing it safely in your brain, and that will still rewire
and have it be safe, because I imagine avoidant attachment situations, the experiences with others have been problematic. We are coming up on another break. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham, who has written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. And how can people contact you, Linda?
My website is lindagraham-mft.net or 415-924-7765.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break and be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're here with my guest, Linda Graham, who has written a book called Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. And before the break, Linda, we were talking about bonding and belonging and about doing these practices that you have in the book with someone or with and the power of the imagination. And during the break, we had talked about also your mentor, and his name is Rick Hansen, and talk a little bit about who Rick Hansen is.
So Rick Hansen is also a psychologist and a teacher of Vipassana meditation out at Spirit Rock. And Rick's book, Buddha's Brain, really also integrated practices from East and West to help us have lives that are more wholesome, more full of love, more full of creativity. And Rick wrote the foreword for Bouncing Back. His new book, Hardwiring Happiness, is really focusing on taking in the good of positive experiences, positive behaviors, and rewiring the brain through that method.
So with this bonding and belonging, coming back to that, it's about creating safety and trust, creating loving kindness, honoring and befriending the self.
So what I could say about that, one of the quotes that's in the book, and it's one of my favorites of all time, from another mentor, Diana Focia, who said that the roots of resilience are to be found in the felt sense of existing in the mind and heart of an empathic, attuned, and self-possessed other. So that's it right there. And what Diana talks about is finding a true other to true self. Now, that could be a therapist, it could be a teacher, it could be a partner, it could be a good friend. But we can also create that sense of true other to our true self in our own imagination when we use our wiser self, when we use a compassionate figure, when we call on a circle of support in our imagination. We're creating that experience of feeling felt and held in the heart and mind of another.
Because that felt sense, I remember I've worked with John Wellwood quite a bit, and I believe the felt sense originally began with Eugene Gendlin.
Right, with focusing. So the felt sense is picking up the signals from the body, all of our somatic wisdom, about what's happening. And there's a lot of wisdom. Remember I was saying the resonant circuit begins with the brainstem. It begins in the lower brain. So there's a lot of wisdom about our experiences that comes through our senses and comes up through our body, through our emotions, which are simply waves of sensation moving through the body. And when we can relate to them as friendly rather than being hostile or antagonistic, then we get a lot more information that our higher brain can use wisely and skillfully to make good decisions. But without that input, we tend to be dry and logical, and that's not always the best way to get through life.
Right, right. And there's many more males who are dry and logical in our culture. And then in chapter 9, you have relational intelligence about mm-hmm. reaching out, setting boundaries, negotiating change, repairing rupture, and most importantly, forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But that can be interpersonal as well as intrapersonal.
Exactly. And that's probably one of the more popular sections of the book because we all could use more skills mm-hmm. in relating to the people important in our lives, skillfully, resiliently, adaptively. And we're not necessarily taught those skills in this culture, male or female. So to learn those skills and rewire the brain where it becomes more natural to set a limit or boundary when that's necessary, it becomes more natural to negotiate a change or ask for a change.
Well, but this is about, again, developing the habit.
We develop skills and then we make them into a habit.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So we have to know what the skill is first.
It seems that I recall there's some self-diagnosis tools mm-hmm. throughout your book.
Well, there's... There's a lot of self-attunement, self-reflection, self-awareness,
right.
which then goes into self-compassion, self-acceptance.
Okay, and developing that best of relationships with oneself.
Right.
And then in your chapter 10, it's recovering resilience through the body. There's a phrase that I've highlighted in my notes here called a window of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the window of tolerance.
So that's a psychological term. It came out of trauma therapy where our natural physiological baseline is a state of being calm and relaxed yet engaged and alert. That's where we operate the best. And we can rev up out of that window of tolerance into fear or anger. We can shut down below it into numbing out or collapsing. And so ideally we want to be in that window of tolerance. I think the Buddhist equivalent of that is equanimity.
Oh, sure.
Where we're engaged with the world, we're not indifferent, but we're not reacting to it either. We can take our own intentional, responsive actions as we choose.
Well, and the cultivating of equanimity, mm-hmm. it would be broadening and widening that window of tolerance.
Exactly. That's exactly what it does. And so one of the key exercises that I teach in the book, but also in every workshop, is hand on the heart. Simply putting your own hand on your own heart and feeling the warm touch on your heart and breathing deeply and breathing in a sense of goodness or trust or safety, and then remembering a moment of feeling safe and loved and cherished. That, for many, many reasons, calms down the fear response. You're releasing the oxytocin, which is the hormone of safety and trust, and that will calm down a panic attack in less than a minute.
That's
so
cool.
I teach all my couples, all my individuals to do that. Right. So you can come back to that window pretty quickly.
Well, and I suppose, because I'm hearing, you know, from people who are not familiar with the efficacy of these techniques, there's a lot of resistance about, how can that possibly help?
So what I found is I just simply ask people, what are you willing to experiment? Are you willing to try? Let's just be open and curious. If it works, fine. If not, we won't do it. And so very often if people are willing to just try and see, something feels different. It's not logical.
And be able to attend to that something feels different.
That's right. So we focus attention on feeling different, not just thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
That's why all my workshops are experiential. Because
mm-hmm.
when people experience it, the science helps. It gives it some credibility. But when they experience it, then they're much more willing to try it again.
Yeah.
Again.
You know, I attended a workshop put on by Milton Erickson's primary apprentice, Ernest Rossi, back in 92, and he was talking about acetylcholine cycles through the brain and so forth, and he did an experiential technique, and everybody was just stunned
mm-hmm.
by the shift in their kinesthetic
mm-hmm.
Experience
mm-hmm.
That was backed up by science. And he talks about also shifting gene expression and so forth. I'd like you to talk about somatic intelligence, which is your chapter 12, and
mm-hmm.
well-being of managing emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the things that, again, I like to teach in every workshop. Oxytocin is the hormone of safety and trust. When we know how to release oxytocin through safe trust, through remembering being loved and cherished, we can feel safe and we can go forward. But there's another way to manage the anxiety that says, stop. We've never done this before. Don't know if this is safe. And that's the dopamine circuit.
Oh, yes.
So when we face something new, unexpected, unpredictable, the dopamine will stop. It will just say, I've never seen this before. The neuroscientists call this the O circuit. So the dopamine stops. In order to get it going again, this sense of satisfaction and pleasure and reward, it's important to do the thing that is scary or causing anxiety. Because very often it's just simply new or unknown, and our body is telling us, whoa, and we just need to be able to try anyway. So one of the exercises is to do one scary thing a day. That comes from Eleanor Roosevelt out of World War II. Do one scary thing a day. And we train our brain, this is also a kind of reconditioning, we train our brain to take a signal of anxiety as a cue to go ahead and try. And that becomes a new pattern within the body. Anxiety comes up. Let me try anyway. Oh, I feel fine taking that action. And so that becomes part of our somatic intelligence.
Well, we're running out of time, and there's a couple of other things that I wanted to ask.
Okay.
The reflection and response flexibility, which you've just spoken about with Eleanor Roosevelt. But I think the most important thing is developing resilience beyond personal self and what is a BOP?
A big organizing principle.
Right.
So we all have values that we live by.
Yeah.
And when we can become conscious of the values that we live by and choose the ones that will lead us in the most wholesome direction, we're learning that we can do that. Once we learn we can create a change in our brain, we know that we can create a change in our brain. And so we're much more likely to tackle bigger and bigger issues because we know that we can, that we can put into practice these tools and create a change in our brain that will allow us to keep opening and expanding. So what happens when our brain becomes more resilient, we become more resilient, and we can take action on a larger stage. We can open up into the larger world and be more effective.
Well, we're coming to the end here. Can you say if there's one thing that you could say to a listener who is just tuning in about resilience and mindfulness and your path, what would you say is most important as a human being?
That the capacity to be resilient, the capacity to bounce back, is innate in the human brain. It can be developed, it can be derailed, we can recover it and rewire it. But it's our birthright to be resilient. And so I've simply tried to present tools and techniques that allow us to recover that birthright and allow us to feel centered and grounded in the face of any adversity or any loss or any challenge. And that's quite available to us in this human existence.